The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the speaker. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your own physician.
All right. Hello. I am Rajiv Saigal, and I'm a member of the NASS section on spinal cord injury together with Dr. Brian Kwan. And we're happy to join you today and to talk about an important topic regarding the role of spinal cord perfusion management in acute traumatic spinal cord injury.
All right. Welcome. I'm Brian Kwan. I'm at the University of British Columbia, orthopedic spine surgeon, and I've had a longstanding interest in this topic in the one of the few things that we do in the acute management of spinal cord injury. So Rajiv, thanks very much for inviting me to participate in this.
Well, thanks for participating. You have definitely been one of the leaders in this field, so it's exciting to get your thoughts on this. And you published quite a bit on the topic of managing spinal cord perfusion and done it in a novel way. That's kind of different from the way many other centers monitor. So I thought maybe we could just start with how you got the idea in the first place to start placing intrathecal catheters in spinal cord injured patients. And what were your initial thoughts when you started down this path?
Yeah, well, I think it's, when I did my PhD, I did a ton of, rodent experiments. And one of the things that, always strikes you when you do a lot of experimental SCI work is you always think, well, how would this make a difference in a human patient? But then from our clinical experience, the things that really struck me were that, when you do monitoring of patients in the OR, and if there is any sort of blip or change or drop in your signals, the first thing that seems to happen is that, you push the blood pressure up. And in many cases that I experienced as a fellow, like that seemed to rectify the situation. And so it's sort of highlighted the fact that the spinal cord is exquisitely sensitive to changes in perfusion, and that you could actually change the physiology of the spinal cord in the human spinal cord with changes in perfusion. And then when we were, when I started my practice here in Vancouver, there was a lot of interest in doing CSF drainage in patients with thoracoabdominal aortic aneurysm procedures. And there was kind of a large body of literature where they were describing, changes in neurological function with these relatively small changes in intrathecal pressure from the CSF drainage. And so I got kind of interested in that. And then I wrote a small grant. And then I ran into one of my vascular surgeon friends and I said, hey, I've been reading about this stuff. And he's like, oh yeah, we do that all the time. it was something that was very kind of normal for them. And so, when you put those concepts together that, okay, there's this whole body of literature about the importance of ischemia and perfusion and acute traumatic injury. We know from our spine experience that like, if there's any change in the neuromonitoring, like you start by driving the pressure up, we have this, essentially evidence of neuroprotection in the thoracoabdominal aortic aneurysm patients in human spinal cord with a reduced incidence of postoperative paraplegia. This all sort of kind of pointed to, a need to at least study this in acute traumatic spinal cord injury. So that's kind of where the idea came from. And then we initiated really a pilot study to test that really back in sort of 2006, 2007, where, we felt that it would be reasonable to try this in acute spinal cord injury, see what would happen if we drained CSF to try to reduce the pressure and really try to assess what was happening to the intrathecal pressure in patients with acute traumatic injury. So that's kind of how it started. And what the thought process was for us initiating that kind of study.
It makes a lot of sense. It's kind of curious that it took so long to cross over from the cardiothoracic and vascular practice over to our practice in spine surgery and spine trauma.
Because there actually had been a prospective randomized trial in the thoracobdominal aortic aneurysm patient population that had been terminated early because of the significant benefit that the patients being randomized to drainage had had achieved. So this, I think, had come out in like 2003 or 2004. And yeah, I had to admit, I was a bit surprised and that this was actually already being implemented in my hospital. But we had never really heard much about it. And then, you know, when you delved into it, you kind of come across, you know, people that say, oh, you know, you shouldn't drain patients with spinal cord, or, you know, you maybe do some, you know, herniation or, and I think there had been some historic literature about, you know, shifting pressure thresholds, but mostly in sort of established chronic myelopathy or tumor situations. And come across any literature in the acute traumatic population to sort of say it suggests this was not going to be safe or feasible. So we thought that it would at least warranted some study.
So I thought next maybe we could just define some terms for our listeners that are necessary to just understand the literature in this area. So could you tell the audience, what is intrathecal pressure, CSF pressure, and intraspinal pressure? What's the difference between those terms?
Well, yeah, it is a bit confusing. And I guess in our institution, where we do place our lumbar catheter, we place our pressure catheters in the lumbar spine, we basically place a lumbar drain, and we have been calling that pressure the intrathecal pressure or the CSF pressure, that which we're measuring with a lumbar catheter that's placed within the cistern and floating in the CSF space. The work that has come out of Marius Papadopoulos's group in London has been really fascinating. They've been doing some groundbreaking work, and their approach has been to put a pressure catheter right at the injury site between the, really into the subdural space between the spinal cord and the dura. And this isn't a drainage catheter, like what is more, I guess, probably more familiar to most people, but this is actually a Codman pressure catheter. And by sliding it into that that space, when the spinal cord swells and pushes up against the dura, that pressure monitor measures a pressure that is reflective of the pressure inside the spinal cord. And they have termed that the intraspinal pressure. And so it is a slightly different, I guess, physiological parameter. And in a sense, if you envision the space around the entire subdural space around the spinal cord, if that space is intact, and there's room around the spinal cord at the spinal cord injury site, then a pressure catheter there is measuring essentially the CSF pressure or the intrathecal pressure. But when you have that swelling of the cord that pushes that pressure catheter against the dura, then in theory, that sensor is measuring the pressure within the cord. And that's why the Papadopoulos group has termed that the intraspinal pressure. So it does reflect a little bit of a difference in how the pressure is actually monitored.
And they have published some work suggesting that the lumbar CSF pressure, intrathecal pressure, might not reflect what's going on at the spinal cord itself. But it seems in North America, for the centers that do this, have been going more the route of the lumbar drain placement. What are your thoughts on this? And do you think it matters where we measure the pressure in the spinal cord?
I think it does. And so I think that some of the work, I think this is where, you know, some of the work that has come out of the Papadopoulos group, and I think a lot of the work that has come out of Bijan Arabi's group is so important, because I think that, you know, conceptually, and I found this when we rolled out our multi-center CSF pressure study, where we were putting where different centers in North America were putting lumbar drains in, that, you know, there is some reluctance from the orthopedic and neurosurgical spine communities about putting in a lumbar catheter into acute SCI patients for fear of I guess, you know, dural leak, dural headaches, infection, meningitis, and whatnot. And I think that the idea of, you know, placing a space occupying lesion at the injury site, you know, if people had pushback around putting in a lumbar drain, I think there'd be some reluctance. I think that that's one of the issues that may, you know, may be a bit of an obstacle around the implementation of that kind of approach. Now, you know, the Papadopoulos group has done a number of patients like this, and they've not demonstrated, you know, any neurological injury. But I think conceptually there is some hesitancy around that. And we found that ourselves when we talked to institutions about even putting in lumbar catheters. Now, having said that, I think it does matter, and it has to do with really the patency of the subdural space around the spinal cord injury site. And when you have that occlusion of the space caused by the swelling of the spinal cord up against the thecal sac, if that is causing significant pressure, then indeed the pressure inside the spinal cord at that level will be different than the pressure that's monitored in the lumbar cistern below. And so I think that, and I think Papadopoulos and their group published a very nice study where they did 13 patients where they did actually put a catheter in the lumbar cistern and one at the injury site. And I think the really important thing that came out of that paper is that indeed in the situations where the spinal cord really swells and pushes up against the thecal sac, then those two pressures are going to be different. And the cases where the relationship is the same are going to be where that swelling is less, where the injury is less, and you don't get that complete occlusion of the subdural space. And so, and they have some beautiful figures in there showing, like, you know, a case where the pressures are equal and then a case where the pressure is much lower in the lumbar cistern. So it really actually raises the question of how you actually get an intact subdural or intact CSF space around the cord at the injury site. And I think this is where Bijan Marabi's work, where they've done postoperative MRIs on their patients, really is super informative, because what Bijan and his group have shown is that if you do a long posterior laminectomy and decompress the cord over multiple levels, then you can get that, you know, the thecal sac to expand, and you can get that intact, what Bijan would call a complete decompression around the cord in over 90% of cases. And so we think that that's actually probably a very important consideration for, you know, measuring pressure with the lumbar catheter, is that it does actually require some thought about ensuring that you're a really good decompression at the injury site and get that SF space around the spinal cord. I guess the proxy of that for us when we do our CSF lumbar catheters is we do look at what the pressure waveform appears like. And we think that when that pressure waveform is completely flat, that probably reflects an occlusion of the subdural space at the injury site. But when that pressure waveform is pulsatile, then that means that there is probably some restoration of flow around the injury site. So we think that the pressure waveform can be actually informative in the lumbar cistern around what the status is at the injury site.
Okay, thanks. That makes a lot of sense. Next, I'd like to just talk big picture about what you've learned in this line of research. In managing spinal cord injury for a couple of decades, really, we were just focused on MAP. And maybe that started around the late 90s. There was a Hadley paper showing the MAP 85 seemed to be beneficial, at least in a single arm study. And really no one was thinking about spinal cord perfusion pressure, but your data seems to suggest that may be a better way of managing these patients than just focusing on a MAP goal. So what have you learned overall? And if SCPP is a better way to manage the patients, why do you think it might be better than just aiming for a high blood pressure?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that, to be fair, I think that in some respects, it's not particularly different than the way neurosurgeons have been viewing perfusion in the brain, for a long time. So I'm sure that us thinking about it this way in the spinal cord is all that necessarily novel or innovative. In some respects, I perceive, and you know, being an orthopedic surgeon, it strikes me that, you know, we're always getting our cases bumped by the neurosurgeon putting in the EVDs, you know, to monitor intracranial pressure and manage patients according to perfusion pressure. You know, so yes, we have some evidence that perhaps the more relevant physiological parameter is indeed the spinal cord perfusion pressure. It is certainly what in this sense, I think we're very much in agreement with the work that Papadopoulos and his team are doing. And I think it makes a lot of intuitive sense to most neurosurgeons that the spinal cord perfusion pressure would probably be more relevant. I guess the bigger issue really is what then is really the best, and what is it that we should really be targeting, and also I guess the practical consideration of, well, if not everybody has the ability to, you know, either put in a pressure, you know, catheter at the injury site or put in a lumbar drain, like how should we kind of manage these patients to try to optimize them? I think the work that has certainly come out of the Marius's group has really sort of revealed that it is certainly conceivable that patients have very different requirements for their optimal perfusion. If you were to look at the degree to which they autoregulate, and there may be some role that to trying to individualize, like, you know, map goals or spinal cord perfusion goals based on the patient. I think that that's probably one of those things that you know, will require study in order to define, like, okay, which patients should be, you know, should be set where, and to some extent will require better monitoring of the injury site than we currently have. But in the meantime, you know, what do we do, and how do we, you know, what do we tell our clinician community about how to manage? I think that, you know, what I've learned in kind of going through this and having looked at the literature around this topic is that we really are uncertain about how well our MAP goals really influence neurological recovery. I think that's the bottom line, and that there's a lot of uncertainty about this area. I think that, you know, I think we're pretty confident that hypotension is bad. And I think one of the good reasons to have a MAP target is so that you minimize the opportunities for patients to become really hypotensive. And we found this in our own institution, looking at our own records, at how hypotensive, for example, the patients were when they were in our emergency room, because we didn't have them on MAP goals. And so, you know, patients are comfortable, they've had their imaging, they're waiting for the OR, and they're sitting there in their, you know, in trauma bay one with a MAP of 60, you know, like, so I think having a target is probably helpful for at least preventing hypotension. But then where should that target be? You know, I think actually a lot of the work coming out of UCSF has been very informative, because it has probably demonstrated to some extent that you don't want to, I think there is probably a limit, and pushing people beyond a limit, an upper level, may be actually deleterious to the cord. And I think some of the work that's been done at UCSF has really been informative around that, that, okay, so you don't want hypotension, but there is also probably a limit as well to how hypertensive you want to make somebody. It's probably, you know, work to be done to define those, that limit. But in between that, you know, we currently have a guideline that says that the patient should be between 85 and 90 for 7 days. And I think that's a guideline that, you know, was published in 2013 and is probably widely misquoted and misunderstood, because it actually, you know, when you review the literature, a lot of people will quote the guidelines as saying, well, it says, you know, we should keep the pressure above 85 for 7 days, or you know, between 85 and 95 for 7 days, but it actually states between 85 to 90 for 7 days. And that is based on literature that, you know, I would say it doesn't necessarily linearly point to those particular levels. In addition to which, as we've shown, and I think you guys have probably experienced too with your Q1 minute recordings, and is that it's actually very hard to keep people at that tight of a target.
Yeah.
There's so much fluctuation in the map, you know, and if the nurses are there, you know, trying to titrate the vasopressors like every minute to try to accommodate them, it's an impossible task to actually keep somebody within a 5 millimeter of mercury target. So I think that, you know, some of the work that we're doing through AO Spine with our guidelines initiative, we're really trying to look at this really in an effort to say, okay, well, what is the literature that we accept as maybe not super strong? What can it tell us about, you know, where a reasonable lower limit would be, what a reasonable upper limit would be, you know, so that we could guide the clinical community with something that is maybe more realistic and still accepts the fact that, you know, we don't really have strong evidence to point to this very narrow and defined target. So that is work that is ongoing, and we hope that through our guidelines initiative that we'll have something to, you know, really kind of help the community, because there's a lot of uncertainty and confusion about this.
Okay.
And it's an area that we have. Well, it is one of the few things that we can do. So, you know, I think everybody wants to, you know, to act in an evidence-based manner, right? Because we
Absolutely.
All feel like there's something that we can do for our patients here.
It seems like one of the benefits of managing these patients with spinal cord perfusion directed care instead of MAP directed care is that you might not need to press them as hard. You might not need to give as many blood pressors if the CSF pressure is not particularly high. In your example, like if they have a very good decompression. And I'm curious if you've seen less pressor use with this perfusion pressure guided management.
Yeah, I would say locally, we probably have not seen that. And that is maybe a bit of an institutional bias. But I think when I kind of peek at some of the data coming in from other centers, I think that there is maybe a movement towards that. And indeed, I think conceptually, particularly based on the work that has come out of UCSF, the very real adverse events that can come from, you know, aggressively driving people with vasopressors, you know, if we can back on some of that, then I think that would be actually a good outcome, you know, particularly for the elderly population. And as we know, that we're getting more and more individuals with spinal cord injuries that are elderly. So I think it's a very relevant consideration when we consider the demographic of acute spinal cord injury today. We have more elderly, they're more prone to the cardiovascular complications from vasopressors. And so if there is a way to provide them perfusion, but with less systemic vasopressor usage, then I think that would be a good outcome.
Okay. As I followed your papers over the years, it seemed like at first your group focused on primarily observational work, putting in the catheters and seeing whether or not that correlated with ultimate outcome. And then recently with the CASPER trial, you have started looking at active drainage. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the thought process behind that and choosing that path. And also just say a little bit about the CASPER trial and what you're hoping to learn now.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, one of the first things we learned when we actually tried to do a PRCT of drainage versus no drainage was that found that the intrathecal pressure, the CSF pressure, was super high in patients, and like surprisingly high, like in the mid-20s in some patients. And we thought, wow, that was very surprising to us. Because, you know, if your intrathecal pressure is 25, then in theory, if you have a MAP of 85, then your spinal cord perfusion pressure is 60. Like, it's one of those sort of unknown variables, and we were surprised at how high it was. So that's actually why we went ahead with an observational study to kind of see, well, what were what are people's CSF pressures after this, and how does that affect their spinal cord perfusion pressure over time? And that was really the purpose of the CAMPER study. So that's kind of why we made that an observational study. The data analysis from that did suggest that the spinal cord perfusion pressure was a more relevant metric. And some of what we learned from the CAMPER trial was that, patients spend a lot of time with an intrathecal pressure above 50. They spend a lot of time with, where their spinal cord perfusion pressures are, below 60 into the 50s, sometimes into the, low 50s. And so, and we did have the experience in the CAMPER trial where our ICU attendings and the nurses were like, wow, like that CSF pressure is super high. Like, shouldn't we drain them? Like, shouldn't we do something like to, to lower that? And we said, no, this is an observational study. Like we're just observing it. But I remember like getting asked a number of times, like, oh, like, don't you think we should do something like with this? So, and to be honest, there had been a number of people, like Nick Theodore had actually tried to run a trial. He started a DoD funded trial. There's enough people, and I think in our community, that were like, yeah, we should actually be draining. Like, this is a very straightforward neurosurgical procedure. Why don't we just drain them? That was so that was kind of the impetus for actually launching the CASPER study, because we felt that, okay, we've understanding now about the pressures. We certainly see patients with some very high CSF or intrathecal pressures. Now, can we actively manage that by reducing that pressure through drainage? And so, I guess that has been the evolution of the thought process. And I think one of the things that, we're kind of learning in the CASPER study is just, okay, well, how do you do that? Do you just set the drain at 15 and just open it up and let it rip and drain people down to there? And some people actually feel very strongly that that sort of pressure drainage is actually very safe and probably the most logical way to go. Others feel like, well, maybe we should set an hourly volume limit so that we don't drain too much at a given time. And so there are lots of actually different ways to sort of approach that. I think that's the things that we're hoping would is for us to come away with, okay, if you're going to try to drain CSF in an acute spinal injury patient, this is actually how we would do it. Like, this is how, this is the protocol for how you would actually achieve that. So that's one thing. I think it's also proven to us that I think a lot of Papadopoulos's insights are probably correct. In the setting where your subdural space is probably closed, then it's actually very hard to drain people because there's just not much CSF to drain distal to the injury site. And so those are probably cases in which like CSF drainage isn't going to be all that helpful, because and on top of which, when the subdural space is closed, then the pressure below that is actually low. And so if you set a pressure threshold to drop, CSF pressure down to 15, then probably already at 15 or below. So so I think that these are all the kind of nuances. And I think one of the things that will emerge from our study is that, there's been lots of talk about, oh yeah, we should drain CSF, lower intrathecal pressure and et cetera, and do it like the thoracoabdominal aneurysm surgeons. But I think to actually protocolize that so that we can understand, okay, well, if you're going to do this, this is how it can be done. And this is what the effects of that are. That's actually why we thought running a study like CASPER would be important. Because after the publication of our CAMPER study, there were a number of centers. UCSF published a protocol that had been instituted. Pittsburgh had started to do this, putting in intrathecal catheters. And we thought, let's take this collective experience and actually study it and protocolize it and actually follow patients. And then we'll be able to say, okay, this is actually, what the impact of trying to drain people, trying to do this very and somewhat intuitive procedure. This is the impact of that on the acute SCI population.
So to follow up on that, I have a practical question. Let's say that you're approached by a spine surgeon or critical care person at another center who wants to change their method of management to be more like this. So let's say go from MAP management, start putting in intrathecal catheters and doing spinal cord perfusion pressure management. What do you think are the important practical considerations for a center starting to do that? Let's say, for example, which Asia grades are appropriate? What are practical considerations for if the patient's moving and zeroing the drain? What number should they shoot for spinal cord perfusion pressure? What are the kind of practical advice you'd give for someone starting out?
Yeah, well, I guess people have asked me, I the first thing I tell them is that, hey, you know what, like we're actually still studying it. And so we, you know, I don't profess to say that, you know, this is like, you know, this is how exactly how patients should be managed. Like, I think there's still a lot of uncertainty in this area. And so people do reach out to me and they say, hey, you know, we heard you're doing this stuff. And, you know, and it's the first thing I tell them is that we're still actively studying it. So I think it is still an area of active investigation. I think that some of the practical things that we've learned is that it does tie the concept of acute hemodynamic management to acute decompressive surgery. So I've probably become, you know, much more conscious about in the decompression part of my cases that, you know, we have a nice, you know, CSF around the cord. I do intraoperative ultrasound to make sure that in the operating room, I feel confident that there's CSF around the cord throughout the rostrocaudal axis of the injury site. And then postoperatively, we, you know, with the drain, we do zero them to the flebostatic axis. We set the, you know, the target intrathecal pressure to 15. And that was kind of based off of our CAMPER data where we thought, like, you know, it was kind of where a lot of patients were and some patients were below that. So we kind of set it at 15. And then we try to, you know, one of the practical limitations of this, of the drainage system is that you can't actually measure the pressure as you're draining, mm-hmm. right? Because you got to open the drain and you got to drain them. And then so we recommend kind of doing a spot check every hour. So you drain, then you turn off the drain, you check the pressure, you wait for, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes to try to get a sense of what the pressure has changed to. And then you open it again if it remains over 15. That's kind of how we've been doing it locally and has been, to some extent, a little bit of the hybrid between just, you know, opening up the drain at 15 and letting it rip and having a bit of a volume, hourly volume limitation to how much you drain. And then we do say that, and our nurses are very, our research nurses are very careful about this. They put signs on the bed like, okay, you know, if you change the height of the bed, if you change the, you know, the head of the bed angulation, the main thing is actually if they change the height of the bed, that like the transducer needs to be re-zero. Like they need to, because those are things that happen, you know, physio comes in, the height of the bed. So they need to be really kind of careful about that in order to make sure that the measurements remain accurate.
Okay, great. So maybe we could finish up by just talking about the future. On one side of that is the unanswered question. So, you know, what are the most important unanswered questions that we need to gather more data to answer regarding managing these patients? And second, technological considerations. Do you think that any new technologies or adjuncts are needed to better manage spinal cord perfusion?
Yeah, so I think, you know, broadly speaking, I think that it would probably help the community to have, you know, I guess better guidance around like what should the MAP target kind of be. And that'll be, you know, I hope through our guidelines development that we'll have something to provide to the community about this, because I'm not sure that the current guidelines are really necessarily all that realistic and all that, you know, applicable in some respects. I think the big black box is really what is going on inside the spinal cord. And without a way to monitor that, I think we're always going to be shooting in the dark a bit. Mary and his group, they wrote a great article about, is injury site monitoring the future? And I think, the work that they've really done some unbelievable work. And I think what is proven to us is that, not surprisingly, patients are different, and so their hemodynamic management requirements are probably different too. So I do think that, the future will really, the big innovation for the future will be some technology that will provide us with at-site monitoring over the course of the early post-operative period. And, one approach, of course, would be to, put the Codman pressure catheters in the spinal cord or put it inside the fecal sac. That's one way to monitor the site. And then you get a proxy of pressure, in a sense. That there's advances in ultrasound, for example. Maybe that could provide information about flow, but then requires the development of implantable ultrasound sort of technologies. We're interested in the development of a sensor for near infrared spectroscopy for oxygenation monitoring. That would be, an epidurally placed sensor that would provide that kind of information over 7 days. So I think that that's an active area of development for us. I think probably the important point is not so much what we're doing, but just the concept that I think the development of something, of a technology, a monitoring methodology to tell us like what is actually happening to the hemodynamic status of the spinal cord in that early post-operative, post-injury phase. I think that's really what's going to be necessary to really advance the field in this. At the end of the day, we're going to have to generate guidance heterogeneity and individual needs of each patient. So that's where I think the future lies.
Well, this has really been excellent. Thank you so much for your time and for contributing so much to the field and really pushing forward the thinking in this area and allowing us to come up with better ways to treat these patients both now and in the future. So I'd like to just thank you and thank our audience for listening in and give you the opportunity if you have any final thoughts.
Yeah, well, thanks very much, Rajiv. I think that it's a great topic because, you and I, like we treat these patients with acute spinal cord injuries and it's so heartbreaking that like when they ask us what we can do for them, that the options are actually so limited that, we're aggressive, we're urgently taking them for surgical decompression. And then we have this perception that there is this potential neuroprotective benefit from their hemodynamic management. And so I think we're all interested in trying to do that better, to try to maximize what we can get out of that that management approach. So I appreciate the invitation to talk about it. I think it's an important one of the few things that we can do. And so trying to do the best we can with that is, I think, an important thing for our field.